arranging the talk, and of course, thanks the Institute very much for hosting me here in this very nice place for the coming 7 months. So, very happy to be here. I'll be talking about my recent work, which is about kind of the idea that you could perhaps study at least part of this quark-gluon plasma formalization, what they find in these experimental things in ALICE, by black hole formation in ADS. So that is kind of the motivation, and it's based on these two papers and one still coming, pretty soon, hopefully. The first one is with Michal Heller in Amsterdam, Dave Mateos and Jorge in Barcelona, and it's more about, it's the part which is colliding shockwaves, you'll see about that. And the second one is more experimental, we really match onto like experimental spectra in the end, which is with Paolo Machka and Scott Pratt, and a little bit more recent. So to do that, I'll start with, it's of course a strong gravity seminar, but I'll spend quite some time actually on heavy ions, so I hope you don't mind that, because, well, also to introduce the topic, of course, since you probably don't know a lot about it. Now, most very briefly, why we use ADS-CFT to study this, and then there are basically two parts, and the first is, so you have this kind of collision, and the first part we study the longitudinal dynamics of this collision. So you have two nuclei, and they collide, and you have some longitudinal dynamics, and we try that to study that with shock waves, and we look at two different regimes, low energy, high energy collisions, and we find also two different responses. Find first that there's no boost invariance. Well, I get to all these kind of things, and then there's some new results, which is this upcoming paper where we study also not even just the longitudinal dynamics, but also dynamics with more microstructure in these shocks, which could have relevance for instance, the recent proton lead collisions. I'll also tell a little bit about. And then the second part, well, the last part is, I think, if I have time for that, actually, it's more, instead of studying the longitudinal dynamics, there's also dynamics in this collision in the transverse plane. And this is then, this quark-gluon plasma will expand radially, and it will induce some radial flow. And we study then this part, neglecting this longitudinal behavior, and at least we simplify it a lot. And then we get, because you then have the full collision, basically, for a central collision, we get this spectra out, and hopefully I'll have time for that. So to start, in these kind of collisions, so you have these, two ions, two heavy ions coming on top of each other, and then, well, they're very big, they're kind of like lead atoms. And then part of it, well, they rarely had collide head-on, so usually they're kind of shifted. And this part just flies on, and this part also just flies on. There's basically nothing. So these are called spectators, and actually you don't really care about them. But in the middle, you have this collision. And then it's quite interesting that there have always been two pictures of this collision, at least at high energies. For instance, when they were doing Rick collisions, they were, of course, predicting what would happen at LHC, and then there are always two pictures. The first picture is basically that at very high energies you have asymptotic freedom. So you would imagine that you have these quarks and gluons colliding, but because of asymptotic freedom, the coupling would be very weak. And you would have a few scatterings pretty much very randomly. And then you would find a lot of particles coming out because of the collision. But because there are just a few random scatterings, you would find particles in the transverse plane almost with equal probability everywhere, kind of a circular shape. So this is kind of the weak coupling picture. But then there's another possibility, which is QCD is strongly coupled, at least at low energies. And if you have strong coupling, you would expect more like a very strong interactions. So it's more, it would be more behave like a fluid with a lot of pressure, and you would have a lot of, it behaves more like a fluid. And then you have a very high pressure in the middle, and then you see that the pressure gradient in this direction is much bigger because of the smaller distance than the pressure gradient in this direction. So what you see is that because of the pressure gradient will expand very rapidly in this direction. And if you then look at your experimental data, the particle spectra, you'll find more particles over here than over here. And this is called elliptic flow because it's kind of induced by this kind of elliptic shape, and this causes more particles over here. And you can very easily see this because you just look at your particles you found and you expand them in spherical harmonics. So you have kind of a, this is then the zeroth order, this is a second order, and you can define V3, V4, V5. And this is why it's called V2. This is the second order spherical harmonic if you decompose all your particles. And then the interesting thing is, of course, they look at LHC and what do they find? They find that the V2 is still increasing. So this suggests that that this asymptotic freedom picture of weak coupling is not at LHC. At least not really valid. At some point it has to go down, but you don't really know, it might go down all the way over here. So this is very good, because it means that the QCD is still strongly coupled, and it means it's still a very difficult theory to solve, and that makes it interesting, and then, well, gives all of us a lot of work to do. So that's very good. So how do people study these kind of collisions? Well, this is the state of the art, and this is this kind of picture I took from Bjorn Schenke's website, where they really start with a collision head on, and you see here the equal temperature surfaces, and you see it's kind of a complicated fluid, and it has some fluctuations because these protons and neutrons are unevenly distributed. And in the end, they kind of convert this fluid back into particles, and this is what they find in they compare with the detector, and this is kind of how they model these heavy ions. So this is kind of complicated numerics, and we are not able to really fully reproduce it, but this is the state of the art in the heavy ion community. And I want to note a little bit two things, is that, yeah, that this works all quite well, but this evolution using hydrodynamics uses a kind of certain viscosity. And what's kind of nice is that this is very close, this viscosity they typically use, the one with what ADCFT predicts is like 1 over 4 pi. But the second thing I want to know is that you need to start with some initial conditions over here. And they do have some kind of idea, like from GLASMA-like pictures, color glass condensate, where they solve classical Young-Mills equations. But at least, so in the transverse plane, there's some idea which kind of initial conditions they start with. But at least in the longitudinal direction, they basically don't really know, and they just put in some flat profile, and then they put some half Gaussian, and that's how they start evolving these kind of things. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the initial condition, and after that, physics gets, they know a lot more, like the viscosity they know a little bit, and then the final spectra they can just compare with. So yeah, the take home message is a little bit that that there are advanced simulations, but the initial state is still very much unknown to some extent. But you can constrain it using this data. So that is what was done a few years ago, and then there's some recent excitement. There are two things. The first thing is that instead of colliding two lead atoms, like the picture on the left, you can also collide a lead atom with a proton. So you have like a very big atom, and they have a proton going right through. So also the rest of the atom just flies on, and you don't really care about it. And then you can kind of get a similar picture, but then much smaller, because the proton is simply much smaller. And people usually thought that, well, they kind of accepted that you would have this elliptic flow in these lead atoms like quark, gluon, plasma. But then they also used to think that protons are much smaller, and hence it cannot really behave fluid-like. If you have a very small, just 5 atoms or something like that, it doesn't form a fluid. So they thought that this proton-lead system would be much too small. But then you compute, and here you see the what they call the double rich phenomena, is that this is a particle-particle correlation function. It's a function of longitudinal direction, and it's a function of this transverse plane. And what you see there is a peak at 0 degrees, and there's a peak at pi degrees, which is exactly this correlation, this V2 I was explaining. So even in these proton-lead collisions, it's a very small system, but even there you see this double rich and this V2. And also, if you compare in more detail, like what kind of particles you form, like pions, kaons, and protons, then it's structured in such a way that suggests that this plasma actually came to thermal equilibrium, because then you can get your particle spectra just with a Boltzmann distribution. Well, and then the second part, so this is kind of this exciting, that this indicates that even there you have hydrodynamic behavior in a very small system. And the second part is here they study the number of particles which come out as a function of the longitudinal direction. So, and here you see the measurement. Well, it looks a little bit like this. So for instance, here, this direction in the longitudinal direction is the lead direction. So the lead is, of course, much heavier, and you find more particles over here. So that makes sense. But you also see that there were various models. And yeah, like 2 or 3 of them, they do pretty well. But the other models don't really. So this also kind of means that these kind of small systems, you really need experimental input, and these models are not really able to predict this data from without doing the experiment. Of course, after that, you can tune all these models to get to the data, but they didn't really predict it correctly, so there's still some work to be done.
And in the other case, when you don't collide the problem with the lead, do the models agree better, or can they push the models?
No, I think it was a very similar situation. Of course, after you get the data, then all the models will agree with the data. But if you ask them to predict the data before the experiment, then it will be, it was, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was a picture like this. also basically because of this uncertainty, asymptotic freedom. And as I already said, I mean, there were seriously half of the community thought that this point would go down because of asymptotic freedom. Probably in hindsight, it was a little bit naive, but it's, they don't really know about this. And then, yeah, so there's a second part, which is not at LHC, but at RIC, actually, they did a very nice experiment. They kind of repeated this gold, well, in RIC, they collide gold nuclei, and they did it at, they didn't do it at their highest energy, but they did it at much lower energy. So they collided at 7.7 GeV, 11.5, or 39 instead of 200. And they also, you also have LHC, 2.76 GeV. And then they compared in a lot of detail. So this is, again, this V2 coefficient. But here's a function of the pions and the kaons with a fixed transverse momentum. So as a function of transverse momentum, they compute this V2, and they compare with the V2, they have a 200 GeV. Normally, they just integrate over all the particles, and they just sum all of them. But here, they do it for each PT individually, for each energy individually, for each particle type, and for a different kind of impact parameters. So some are head-on, some are a little bit off-center. And what they then found was that although all these models kind of predict correctly this integrated V2, like this, these kind of points all the models will agree on, but they also asked these, yeah, the Avian modelists to predict and all the other data neatly sorted out in different energies and all that, and you see it's a little bit of a mess. So for instance, these round things are the LHC results. And it depends a little bit what initial condition you use. So here they use like a random throwing nucleons in an atom, and here they use more like a Young-Mills field type of initial condition. So that depends a little bit which models you do, but they never can fit all the data. So this caused a little bit of a stir because it kind of means that hydrodynamics is still a little bit incomplete because you can maybe fit a few of them, but then you miss the other results. So there's not really a complete model yet. And that's where we come then, of course, because there's this uncertainty in initial conditions. So we want to kind of study this thermalization using perhaps some strong coupling techniques because it's physically strongly coupled. And then you get this story, which you probably all know, but because I'm from Utrecht, I thought I wanted to present it anyway. So this is a very nice idea that you have a very old wet hoofd. The idea is kind of you have two quarks, and in QCD is strongly coupled, so you need to sum over all Feynman diagrams, and of course these kind of diagrams are very, very difficult to compute, probably impossible. But the idea is that if you have these two quarks coming in, you need to sum over all these kind of diagrams, then in the limit of a very large number of colors, this simplifies. And this is very easy to see, because for instance, if you imagine that you draw an extra edge over here, you get an extra coupling over there, G, extra coupling G over there, and you get an extra loop. So you get an extra factor of G squared N, called that Hoeft coupling. But if you draw an extra edge from here to there, you get an extra G over here, extra G over there. But what you actually do is you combine these two loops, and you get an extra, you get a factor of N less, because yeah, there are N colors running through these loops. So if you combine these two things like this, then you get a factor G squared over N. And then the idea is that if you take like N really, really big, then these kind of diagrams, which you cannot draw on a plane, are suppressed. And so in the what are then also called the planar limit, you only have to think about diagrams which you can draw on a plane. And then a little bit speculation of Hoeft was that, yeah, if you really go to very strongly coupled theories, then you can, well, all these things get really tiny, and you can perhaps see this as a quark, as a string over here, and some continuous type of integral like this. So it's kind of a string theory. And then the diagrams you cannot draw on a plane are loop diagrams. And these are then suppressed since you cannot draw it on a plane. So if you can rewrite it as a string theory, you don't have to do the loops. And then that is then a big simplification. And then it took like another 20 years before Maldacena came, and he made this string theory connection a little bit more precise, not for QCD, but for NS4 super Young-Mills. And he then also showed that, well, so that if you take this lambda to be really, really large, so here you have strong coupling, but then you have large N, but then you also need to take this lambda to be really large, then the size of these strings, the string tension becomes really big, so the size of the strings becomes really small, and these strings act like particles again, and as you want, would expect as you want, you just get classical physics out without any loops, so no quantum mechanics, just classical physics. And as you know, that string theory is supposed to be a theory of everything, so you naturally are left in a setting where QCD is described in terms of gravitational physics. Because string theory has gravity and scalar fields and all that, so that's why we are doing these calculations in gravity, and this is a kind of the motivation. But then, of course, yeah, so then the question always is then, are we then perhaps not cheating by using these NS4 supernormals? And the obvious answer is that, of course, we are cheating a lot, because there's a big difference between NS4 supernormals and QCD. But on the other hand, we're studying this problem where two ions collide, and it's at very high temperature. And well, my argument will be a little bit that in this regime where you're studying the initial conditions and just the thermalization for a short time, that this cheat might not be as bad as it seems. And the first argument is, well, so in QCD there are only three colors, and we're approximated with infinite colors, and it seems really bad. But if you then look, for instance, at lattice data, then what they can compute is here, well, here they compute in thermal physics, they can compute quite accurately the energy density over the temperature to the fourth, so dimensionless number. They compute it for SU3, SU4, SU5, SU6. You see it all neatly lies on one line. So at least for thermal physics, let us suggest that this is not a bad approximation. And for in ADS-CFT, for instance, you predict that this line will be perfectly straight since there are no scales in NS4 supernormals. And as you see that at high temperatures, well, it's not completely straight, but it's not a very bad approximation. If you want to do ADS-CFT, NS4 supernormals, and QCD in this regime, you'd be making a very bad approximation. But in this regime, it's not so clear. It's approximately conformal, and you might be doing, well, the error might not be so bad. Yeah, and another criticism you could make that we're doing NS4 supernormals, which is a supersymmetric theory, and you have a lot of gluons and all kinds of his superpartners. But for instance, there are no fundamental quarks, whereas in these ions, you are colliding fundamental quarks. But then, yeah, there are more gluons than quarks anyway, and you hope that in these kind of diagrams, the gluons mostly dominate, at least also at high temperature, because the gluons are effectively massless, and all the other supersymmetric particles, they get an effective mass of order of the temperature. So you break supersymmetry by putting high temperature, and you also give all the other particles a different mass, so that might help a little bit doing this approximation. And then probably the worst is that we use this very, very strong coupling to make the theory classical, whereas, yeah, you know that the QCD, at least the coupling is not infinitely strong. It really goes to zero at asymptotically high temperatures, and yeah, this I don't have a good argument for. And you can see that the theories are also not the same. So for instance, if you compare the energy density as a function of t to the 4 for QCD with three colors, you get about 33, and lattice QCD, you get 11, so this factor of three difference, which tells you that NS4 supernormals has more degrees of freedom than QCD. So yeah, so the message is a little bit that there's some room for improvement. I mean, you can also change your ADS-CFT to get closer to all these kind of things and to try and model more, but that's not what I will do, but you also can. The gluons are massless, but in the rest of the supersymmetric particles, they get an effective mass, so they're a little bit suppressed. But in this case, you can see that they're still contributing to what you're computing. So, I mean, in some sense, we're not doing anything. We're just colliding some energy density, and then we match the energy density of our NS4 supernormals with the energy density of QCD. Right. Yeah, and then you're. So this is, I think, true. That in the end, I mean, the at low temperature, at some temperature, the gluons are dominating, but then there's still of order of the temperature other contributions, and those you're not taking into account. And so you're making some error, but it might not be as bad as you would think. Good, so that was kind of my introduction to why you would want to, why heavy ions has these kind of problems, and why we are interested in this initial state, and why you can argue that ADCFT suggests that maybe for strongly coupled field theories, the gravitational setup in anti-de Sitter, this case, is the preferred kind of setup. So then we want to study a specific problem, and in this case, we study this longitudinal dynamics, as I already said. And to simplify the calculation a little bit, we assume that the if we studied longitudinal dynamics, that these nuclei, if you want, are homogeneous in the transverse plane. So there's a complete symmetry, nothing depends on the transverse coordinates, and this, of course, simplifies your calculation a lot. And you can kind of think about it as colliding infinitely large nuclei, which might sound a little bit weird, but on the other hand, you have to imagine that these nuclei are about 15 femtometers in diameter, and this fermionization stage we're interested in is like less than half a femtometer. So in the time scale of this fermionization time scale we're interested in, these nuclei are actually very big. So this is probably not the worst approximation. They're probably much worse things. And what we then do is you collide, so you want to put some energy density in the longitudinal direction. So this is the longitudinal direction, this is time. So you start with some energy density, and in this case, this is a famous example by Chesler and Yaffe. We didn't compute this, but I'll come to that. So they put a Gaussian over here, which has a certain height and a certain width. So it's two parameters. But then it's a conformal field theory, so only dimensionless ratios matter. So actually, effectively, there's only one parameter, which is the dimensionless ratio of these width and the energy density, the height of the energy density. And if you put some energy density in the field theory, and you demand that it moves at the speed of light completely stationary, so it doesn't change over time, and this is kind of the initial condition. So you have a shock moving with constant speed, with the speed of light, not changing its energy density, then you can completely fix your ADS geometry, because there's only, well, there are several geometries which have the same energy density profile in ADS, but there's only one which keeps constant as a function of time. Well, then you have this one shock geometry, and then you put another one in the other direction, and then you try to collide them in ADS and see what happens. And in this case, what Jessler and Yaffe found, they come together, they kind of the energy density doubles a little bit more actually, and then what they find is that in this region already very very quickly hydrodynamics applies, and they get some expanding plasma governed by hydrodynamics, where these maxima move out with approximately 85% of the speed of light. Right.
And then what do you do in the bulk view? You say that the path has to be dispersion less?
Yes, basically, yeah.
But that's
possible,
right? So
if they move at the speed of light, it's almost very natural that it doesn't change.
And moving at the speed of light, where? Because, you know,
in the
light, first of all, changes as they move inside the air.
So you demand that this. In the field theory, you demand that this energy density moves at the speed of light and doesn't change. So it's a function of t plus y, with y the longitudinal direction only. It doesn't depend on time, it only depends on t plus y, so it moves at the speed of light. So this is kind of defined at the boundary, and actually it's more general. So here we do it only for longitudinal dynamics, but you could put also non-trivial shapes in the transverse plane. You can put any energy density you want, any one-point function in the boundary, and then by demanding that it moves at a constant speed and doesn't change over time, you completely fix the extra direction in the ADS where you need to put your initial condition. There's one extra assumption, and that's we're using only gravity in this case. So there you could imagine adding like electromagnetic fields, scalar fields in ADS, and that could all do that, but we're treating only gravity. And one thing I want to say about it is that if you go to really high energies, is that you have the gravitational force couples with energy, it grows with energy. But electromagnetic forces, they grow with charge. So at very high energies, the gravitational force gets stronger and stronger. So at high energies, you can see that the gravitational force will be dominant. So you can be interested in what happens if you collide, for instance, charged shock waves. But my point is that at high energies, at least this profile will be the leading order, and then you have corrections if you add extra fields. Well, that's not essential. It's true that they do it that way.
No, I think it is essential. So I want to know what do they do and what do you do?
Right. So, right. So that indeed we do. So there are some. There are a lot of technicalities. I mean, here I'm cheating a little bit that I don't say. I mean, so we're starting in this null slice some initial state. I think I defined this initial state. And then we want to solve Einstein equations over here. And by starting with this null slice, we have 2 plus 1 dimensional Einstein equations because there's one longitudinal direction, one extra direction in the ADS. There's time. And by doing it this way, we simplify the Einstein equation a lot. I mean, it's not like we're doing black hole mergers or supercomputers or anything like that. It's because we're using this characteristic formulation, so-called. You can just solve linear equations and time step, and you do a lot of time steps, and then you solve this in Mathematica actually in a week or so. So that is kind of the technicality. So they're nested linear equations. So in effect, they're nonlinear, of course. Einstein equations are coupled nonlinear PDEs. But by going to this null slice, you can split them out in a linear equation, and then another linear one. So you're solving 5 linear equations, and then you're effectively solving the full nonlinear system. So it's a very smart trick. So I'm coming to that. So I wanted to say a little bit that I'm cheating by not saying the technical things. So this, I think, is well defined. But then to keep this dynamics stable, what we do is we add a very tiny energy density, like 2% of this peak energy density. And by adding some very small energy density, then you form already a black hole in the beginning, a rather big one. And this black hole absorbs a lot of radiation and also numerical errors. So this stabilizes your code a lot. And then what we always do, we do 2 simulations, one with 2%, one with 4% energy density. And then we check that you take the limit. You can take the limit to 0, and it's a well-behaved limit. So as it turns out, you don't really need that. So of course, it gets easier if you introduce some energy density, you easily get a horizon. But in their new paper of Chester Yaffa, I didn't manage to do it myself yet, they really solve the full dynamics with 0 energy density. So there they don't put this regulator energy density. So this is possible, at least if you compactify your longitudinal dimension. No, because it's an apparent horizon, and it's not a completely local quantity. So if you have some shocks over here, and they are there's some finite distance apart, then there's some curvature in the ADS over here, and you have a second order differential equation to determine your apparent horizon with non-trivial boundary conditions that it's compactified. And because it's a non-trivial differential equation, you have some curvature, you already get an apparent horizon, even though they're separated and haven't started to collide yet. So in that sense, it's a little bit of a funny, an apparent horizon is a little bit non-local in that sense. It's you can define it at a specified time, but it's not a completely local equation. And so as it turns out, the apparent horizon is already present, and that's why you can do these things. It's just a planar horizon. It's very simple in that sense.
Well, here you're getting away with that because you're using the characteristic approach. For any signal in boundary propagation, simultaneously all the way inside, we're using a space-like hypersurface instead.
Then it might not have worked. I didn't check that. It might still work. Yeah, that's of course the other thing. I mean, if you use a slice like this, if the shocks collide here in the boundary, then they collide already earlier in this coordinate time, deep in the bulk. So actually, these shocks, they already started to collide inside the bulk at this time, where they're still well separated in the boundary, which is an artifact of your time slicing. So that's. So they're just pure gravity. So it's a gravitational waves.
Okay, but what are you preserving?
Yeah, so these are completely homogeneous in the transverse plane. So this is some energy density in the longitudinal direction colliding, but completely infinite in the extra dimensions and completely constant. So the metric looks like, yeah, so it's adding the Finkelstein metric. I didn't write it down here, but it's.
Isn't this in Poincaré patch? Isn't this in Poincaré patch? The boundary is the springing on top of the plane with some self-gravity, two shock waves that come this way.
So Birkhoff's theorem would imply in this case? What would the Birkhoff theorem imply in this?
Well, he has two coordinates. He has set in the boundary R towards the ball, yeah. And when he talks to, it's just transverse with respect to set. So he has two extra
So there are five dimensions, right? It's 4 plus 1. So you have the coordinate z and t in the boundary, then there's an extra coordinate r going into the ADS, yes. And then the two extra transverse coordinates, and I assume that everything doesn't depend on these two extra coordinates. And then I wrote down my metric.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Good, yeah, so it's important, yeah, it's very important that we understand this setup. So is the setup now clear? I didn't completely say how you do it in numeric solving this evolution, but if you then collide this, you can read off the energy density again, and you kind of find these kind of results. Very good, so then I'll go on. So what we then did, I mean, this is a nice model of thermalization with this longitudinal direction. So we looked at it a little bit more, and what we then did was, at least at first, was very simple. Instead of having this energy density and this width, we just kept this energy density the same, and we changed the width. So because, yeah, only the dimensions ratio matters, so we just changed the width, and then we get different physics because dimensions number changes. What happens over here, you can already see a little bit, is that if you make the width twice as big, in this case, you see it gets a little bit different because here this peak is about 3 times higher than the initial peak energy density. Here it's about double the height, but here it's 3 times. And how do you understand that? It's because we have two very wide shocks, and at the moment they get to overlap, they already start thermalizing, you say. So it's more like, and then yeah, it comes to a stop because of this thermalization, and it kind of piles up its energy, and you get a much higher peak than in this narrower shock. So that's already quite interesting. You get this peak, and you can also check that at the moment you form this peak, you still have like approximately a Gaussian, and it's fully described by hydrodynamics at that time already. So it's fully thermalized. And what then happens after that is it's almost trivial. It just explodes by hydrodynamics. So we compute it using gravity, but you can also compute it with hydrodynamics, and it's just a hydrodynamic explosion. And these peaks actually go a little bit faster than in this case because you have larger gradients. So that was already quite interesting. So there's some dynamics if you make the width higher. But then the really interesting point for us, which points to a different regime, and what we also hoped a little bit to find, is that if you make this width like 8 times thinner, the shocks are so thin that they don't have time to thermalize in the time of their width. So what happens is they just pass through. And in the end, these shocks lose energy. You see that they decrease. And you see some energy forming in the middle. And this, indeed, at some specified time later on, it is described by hydrodynamics. But you see there are very different regimes in the shocks, where here they just pass through. You have some negative energy density over here. And you have some plasma forming in the middle. So this we probably didn't completely expect. And you see, for instance, also that if you look at the energy density in the middle, you see that, well, there's a very big peak over here. But then there is because of the shocks, of course, then they pass through, and then the shocks are gone, and you have a minimum. And only after that, the energy density starts growing. And then due to the expansion, the energy density decreases again. So here you have two peaks, whereas in the previous case, you only had one peak. No, this is just exactly twice the initial one.
I see.
Right.
And you can make it higher than twice
by making it very broad. Yeah.
What about the movement effect of dynamic force? Is it roughly the same, just basically when the peak is small, or is there again a difference?
There is a difference, but in the end, it's also the same. The difference is that here, indeed, hydrodynamics applies already at the peak,
right.
And here only later on. But it's also the same in the sense that hydrodynamics applies in a time of approximately 1 over the temperature, or 1/4 over the temperature, something like that. But here, you have much wider shocks. So this 1 over the temperature actually is fast enough to already thermalize during the collision itself. But here, 1 over the temperature is much later than the width of the shocks. So it's kind of comparing the width of the shock with the temperature of the plasma. And that makes these two different
groups.
Viscous hydrodynamics, first order viscous hydrodynamics. Yeah, so from these kind of plots, you can, this is the full stress energy tensor. And then you can go to the local rest frame by boosting. And in the local rest frame is defined by the frame where there's no momentum flow. So this is a, and this boost velocity defines your local velocity. And in that frame, you also have a local energy density. And then you write down your laws of hydrodynamics. And hydrodynamics will give you what the pressures are by gradient expansion and the rest of the stress tensor. But we also have the full stress tensor. So we can compare what hydrodynamics predicts with the full stress tensor. And that's why we know when hydrodynamics is applicable. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that reminds me of some other simulations, like people did for short of curve, but oh, they prepared this initial Gaussian pulse, and then evolve, and the Gaussian pulse, they go from different paths around the hole, and when they try, they go to the
All right. So they have a pulse and it goes around the black hole and then it collides after the black hole and you get also kind of this diagonal. Okay, I'm interested in that. Yeah. Thanks. Good. So yeah, so that is the crossover and well, let's skip this because I'll just point it out in the comparison. So at low energies, you have kind of this piling up of energies and at high energies, it just passes through. And here you also see this regime where hydrodynamics is applicable. So it's here it's kind of a curve and not applicable at the shocks at all. And here it's kind of applicable already from the point of the peak. And for instance, there is also a difference. So this RIC this low energy, which it could be kind of where it's a little bit wider. So of course this width corresponds to energy because at very high energies you have much more Lorentz contraction and you go to much narrower shocks. So very narrow shocks are very high energy. And at RIC it would be like this, maybe this Chesler-Yaffe-like shocks or a little bit below it, the thick ones. And this was called the Landau model where they just assume that these shocks completely overlap. At the time they completely overlap, they're completely thermalized. So this was exactly what was found in these kind of Chesler-Yaffe-like simulations. And for that, you can, for instance, get some entropy scaling, and it will go like the energy of the nucleus to the power 1/2, if you assume this Landau model, which we kind of found in a dynamical setting. Whereas this Landau model typically was only assumption, we kind of had a dynamical setting which produces this model. Whereas in high energy, it will just pass through, and you also have a different scaling of the entropy. In high energy, actually, this width doesn't matter so much. There's only one scale, and then by conformal invariance, you fix your entropy energy relation to be this to the power 2/3. Whereas here, you have an extra scale, the width. The width is then, of course, important. So this is the kind of this dynamical crossover. Entropy density per entropy per transverse density. And in this case, it's would be after the thermalization, I guess. Then you, in this case, we would look at the apparent horizon, for instance. Yeah. But this corresponds at least for in locally in for stationary black holes. This would be a correspondence. So I would apply it at late times. Yeah, it's a result. I think there's nothing wrong with this negative energy density over here. We didn't really expect it. But it's a very far from equilibrium strongly coupled quantum field theory. So it also goes away. At some point, you have this very positive energy of the shock, and you have a little bit of negative energy density next to the shock. And at some point, it goes up again, and it probably will become positive at some point.
Okay, this is just in the boundary?
This is just all in the boundary. Yeah. So in the ADS, we just have gravity. So there's no stress tensor at all. So there's only gravity. This is in the boundary, but this was a little bit surprising. I mean, in classical theories, you wouldn't have this in hydrodynamics. Negative energy density is totally not allowed. It's really far from equilibrium effect.
Right.
Well, just one thing, so that how the negative does it go? Have you checked whether there's any dependence with your, what you call it, regulator, or what Alex was asking, your initial energy box?
Yeah, we checked all that very carefully.
It doesn't vary.
Well, it will vary a little bit, but you can take very properly the limit to zero regulator, and that's always what we plot.
But in which direction does it vary? Does it go up if it be non-zero?
Yeah, if you have some regulator energy density, it will absorb these shocks, and you will have higher, less negative energy density.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
so
pretty sure about that.
I guess maybe a question would be that it might not be No, that's a much better question.
No, I don't know the answer anymore. We should talk about, I'm not completely aware of this, because we just used the standard holographic randomization by Kostas Skanderas taught us in this big paper, and but there I'm not completely sure, because there he just derives very general formulas for the expectation value of the stress tensor in terms of the metric. So here we don't have any sources at the boundary, right? So that might be important. We have just have a flat boundary metric.
Out, right?
And
so you don't have,
okay, but if you tell me afterwards how Kostas is imprecise, I would be happy to know that, of course. Yeah.
But
let's talk about it later. Let's talk about it. Yeah, because I have a lot of, I'm halfway, I think. So, good. I think that's part of the reason why we like to just have a flat boundary metric. You have a CFT living in flat space, and that, of course, in the real world, is also a flat space where we're colliding in. We don't have any curved QFT here. But so then very quickly to point out is this, we also looked on this for heavy ions, it's very important. There they always they assume very often that you have boost invariance, which kind of means that if you plot here what I plot is the local energy density divided by the local energy density at mid-rapidity. So you have kind of, so you plot it as a function of proper time and rapidity. And if you, so in the middle at mid-rapidity, you have some energy density. And if it would be boost invariant, it would mean that if you boost it with some velocity, that the temperature or any quantity over here would be independent of this boost. This is called what boost invariance means. And the idea in heavy ions was always this Bjork, was a conjecture by Bjorken, 1983, is that if you go to really high energies, then the particle spectra, as you also find experimentally, becomes more and more boost invariant. As for instance, opposed to, you have kind of two pictures. Landau picture was you have these colliding ions, they completely stop, and all the velocities are zero, there's no boost invariance at all. If you boost, it's completely different. Or you have a Bjorken type picture, if you boost, it remains completely the same. And what do we find? We normalize here with the energy density, local energy density of mid-rapidity as a function of rapidity, and then you see it varies quite a lot, actually. So if you go one unit of rapidity, then it decreases already by 30%. So this is not boost invariant at all. Although recently, like Chesney and Jaffa, they found out that if you kind of, they simulate a little bit longer, and they say that this tube remains approximately constant as a function of proper time. So they say that there's no global boost invariant, non-boost invariant, but approximately over at some fixed rapidity, it's approximately boost invariant. But in any case, it's not a realization of the Bjorken model as that it gets flatter and flatter, because as I'll argue a little bit later also, that if you go to even higher energies, the shape remains the same. And that I'll argue in four slides. Well, the basic argument is at even higher energies, the width gets even smaller. And we found out that this width, if you are smaller at small enough widths, it doesn't really matter anymore, and the whole plasma will be the same. So hence, the shape will also be the same at asymptotically high energies. This was advanced back of the envelope calculation. So we didn't find this boost invariance, whereas experimentally you do find in the spectra more or less boost invariant, at least for much larger range of rapidities. But this is not necessarily inconsistent because we're just looking at the initial states. So we're saying that initially you don't have boost invariance, but then you have this hydrodynamic explosion, and you generate, of course, a lot of longitudinal velocities. So it doesn't mean that the final at late times, it is it doesn't imply the rapidity profile at late times, so there's not necessarily any contradiction with the experiments. You want to kind of change your initial conditions to get more boost invariance?
No, I'm just curious. So you're saying that there is no boost invariance, but that's subject to your initial condition where you collide shockwaves, and those are special types of shockwaves where you have, you're specifying the initial condition not just near the boundary, but also in the bound.
Yeah, but I think we're choosing the right initial condition, because if you have a nuclei, then it also just keeps on moving and it doesn't change, right, for a very long time. So that's why we...
Yeah, I'm not questioning right or wrong.
Yeah.
But
the
possible. The principle it should be possible.
Of course. So the short answer is that we didn't check this. Yeah. Very good. So now, one also a little bit quickly is that we have some understanding why this transparency happens in the bulk. Because we have some ADS boundary, and we fix it, of course, by the demanding that spacetime is flat. And you have these shockwaves colliding in the bulk, in ADS. And what happens is that near the boundary, these shockwaves are small perturbation of ADS, because you fix the near boundary metric, so the stress tensor is a subleading order. So the metric is a small perturbation of ADS. And then you have these two gravitational waves, and because they're small perturbation, they're basically governed by linear equations, near the boundary, at least, so where you fix the geometry. So this kind of explains, if you just have a linear evolution near the boundary, then if you have these incoming dash shocks, then these green ones are just like traveled through with the speed of light, and you have this other blue one. This is the full solution. It kind of means that, so linear wave equation, you just have to move through. So because of the linear wave superposition. Of course, general relativity is a very nonlinear theory, so this argument applies near the boundary, but it doesn't apply at all in the bulk. There you just have black hole formation, and you have strong curvature and strong gravity. But on the other hand, so it collides in the bulk at some depth, but then by causality, it takes some time to reach the boundary. So initially, they just have to pass through, and only later on, after this time that this strong gravity can reach the boundary, you see this plasma forming, which kind of explains why it takes some time to change the plasma, and also why it takes some time to change these shocks. And you see that it has to even, these shocks move with the speed of light, so it takes a lot of time to catch up with these shocks. And you see that here the front of the shock is not touched at all, and here it kind of is not completely the front, so here it could catch up and has changed the shock shape. This is how we understand this transparency regime from the ADS point of view. Well, so the Ricci scalar is, of course, this constant because we're using vacuum. So you could go to the Kretschmann scalar. We checked at some point, not in this setting, the Kretschmann scalar, and could get quite large, I guess. So yeah, to be honest, in the shockwave, we didn't compute the Kretschmann. So and the rest of the curvature is trivially, it's ADS curvature. But at least the equations are nonlinear. I mean, that's kind of clear. If you have black hole formation, I suppose you have strong curvature. I mean, so we still, not compared to the Planck scale, I mean, we're still just in the classical limit. If you have a large n, we're always. Good, then of course I want to go to the little bit of newer results. So this is kind of these narrow shocks we did at some point, plotted at some time, like twice the time hydrodynamics applies. So you see these shocks, see this negative energy density, and here this plasma in the middle. And then we wondered, for instance, if you look at a proton nucleus collision, you have a proton which is kind of a very peaked energy density. But if it hits a nucleus, it will hit like 7 or 8 nucleons, which have a very different kind of longitudinal profile. But both will be very narrow because of the Lorentz boost. So you can wonder what happens. So here we just collide two Gaussians, so that's very boring. So we wonder what happens if we change this. And what we did is we collide this original very narrow Gaussian, but the other one we replaced by two Gaussians with a little bit of a separation. And then we wondered what happened. And the very interesting thing is that what we saw is that this plasma remains almost exactly unchanged. So this plasma is not sensitive at all to the shape of these shocks. Of course, we're still in the same center of mass frame. So the total energy is still fixed. So you would, for instance, in this proton lead collisions, you would have one proton hitting like 8 other neutrons protons. So this would be much heavier, much more energy than the single proton. But of course, you can do a trivial boost to the center of mass frame. And then that's what we're talking about. We're always talking about center of mass collisions. And then to check this a little bit, well, actually, I did this first. You have this double shock against the double shock. And again, you see that it's almost exactly at the same place. And you can compare also with simulation I was already done, which is a little bit of a wider shock, at the same total energy again. And you see exactly this plasma is unchanged in the middle. Of course, at some point, this has to go wrong. That is, if you just separate them infinitely far away and make a very big shock, then you do notice a difference in the middle, which is very natural. And you see that for wider shocks and also for asymmetric shocks, it all makes a difference in the plasma. So you have to be in a narrow enough regime, but then we find what we call this longitudinal coherence. And it's, it might seem quite natural, but we think it's an important conclusion for these proton lead collisions, because it would simplify the whole computation a lot. You just have this one proton, you have 8 or 12 or 5 other constituents where you collide with, and then you take all this energy density together, you go to the center of mass frame, and then you know that in particular it is symmetric around mid-rapidity. And you actually know that the only thing that happens is the total energy density, and it's symmetric around this mid-rapidity. And this is actually pretty different what they do in real simulations of these proton lead collisions. There they would always go to a nucleon-nucleon center of mass frame, would treat all the collisions of these nucleon-nucleons individually and then sum it up, and then it's depends a lot on the coupling constant of QCD, what actually comes out. So it's a different way of thinking about it. And in some sense, I find it very natural also from the bulk point of view, because what we actually do if you plot this energy density function of time and space, so here you have these two small ones against one big one, and it's very symmetric over here. To some extent, it's very natural. If you look from the point of view of the plasma, it's kind of probes the thermal scale, and it's kind of a horizon quantity that it cannot really resolve these two shocks if it's much less than 1/10 temperature. And this is what we plot over here. This is I call it the entropy density, but it's really just the area of the parent horizon we compute. And what you see is that here, you just have, instead of having these two peaks over here in this UV quantity near the boundary, we're computing this IR horizon quantity, and you just have one peak because the horizon cannot resolve this UV structure if it's less than 1/10 temperature. So actually this is a very asymmetric collision, but if you look at the horizon, it's almost perfectly symmetric. Whereas, of course, if you then separate these two single shocks far enough, then you see again that this apparent horizon will have these two peaks, but then the peaks are still smoothened out, what you would expect. And actually, yeah, this was already a little bit, but there's one heavy emphasis, Peter Steinberg, which thought about his lambda models and his stopping and had these ideas a little kind of before. So it's not, so he tried in Pythia indeed to go to the center of mass frame, which is a boost, which is basically just a shift in rapidity. And then he put it in Pythia, which is kind of the heavy ion program to generate the spectra. And it's a little bit subtle because you need to go from rapidity to pseudo rapidity, which is what they actually measure. And what he found is that if you look at the data, this is then a trick for deuterium gold, that you can fit this very nicely by just boosting a symmetric proton-proton distribution. At LHC, we cannot really check because they measure as a function of rapidity, and we are really interested in this maximum where you find most particles. But then you see that the data stops very quickly already before the maximum. So we don't have much to say about that. Well, so questions about this coherence? Because then I'll just spend 1 minute on this slide, which is to advertise this work with Paolo Machki, and it's called PRET, which is the radial flow. So what we did there is it's a little bit of a different product. I just spent 3 minutes on advertising that a little bit. So there we didn't look at the longitudinal dynamics, but as most of the heavy ion community does, actually, we just assumed that the longitudinal dynamic is boost invariant. Well, I just told you it wasn't really boost invariant, but we did it anyway. And that simplifies the longitudinal dynamic, but then we have an extra dimension in my numerical code to study at least rotationally symmetric dynamics in the transverse plane. So we can do some radial flow. And that allows you to study really a head-on heavy ion collision, because then you can study the radial flow all the way, and you see the dispersion in the longitudinal direction by boost invariance, you see the expansion in the radial dynamics. And what then the nice thing was about this new approach is that we collaborated with Paolo Machki, which is an expert in heavy ion hydrodynamics. So he has a state-of-the-art hydrodynamic code to evolve with real QCD equation of state, with real, well, everything, viscous corrections. And then Scott Pratt is, he was doing more, not hydrodynamics, but after hydrodynamics, you convert it into particles, hadronic particles. And at the deconfinement temperature, 170 MeV, and you get these scatter a little bit, like a gas of particles, and they scatter a little bit, and you can compute the scattering, it's called a hadronic cascade, until they don't scatter anymore and they end up in the detector, and then you get your results. So what's the nice thing about this project here is time, proper time, because it's a boost invariant setting, it's a logarithmic scale, by the way. This is the radius, so you have this spherical symmetric system, so it's about, the radius of a nucleus is about 7 femtometers. And you see that, as in the shock waves, first the energy density increases, which we did by a small time expansion near the boundary. Then I used this numerical code to solve the full Einstein equations numerically. This is kind of my contribution. And then at some point, you check that hydrodynamics applies, and then you switch to this real QCD code, which is also really nice. So ADS, as I told you, it's kind of a very bad approximation to QCD to some extent. But we only use it for this part. So at 1 femtometer, we switch to real QCD hydro. And here we don't make the ADS CFT assumption anymore. And then you go to a deconfinement phase where you convert your fluid into particles. You do this cascade code by Scott Pratt, and you couple all these things together. And you kind of have this fully dynamical model of this heavy ion collision. And you get out your spectra. So at that point, you are very happy. Because here you see the LS data, and you see all kinds of simulations we did with different parameters which you could tune. But, we had some tuning, like for instance, where we start our numerical code, or we had an extra parameter to fix the horizon position. But then we normalized an initial energy density. We normalized this energy density to be just to cover the total, to fix the total multiplicity. It's very common practice in heavy ions too. And then you see that you get all the data points spot on. And the nice thing about this simulation is that, so there are other simulations, actually there are these two others, which can also fit the data spot on. And most of them actually do fit the data spot on. But they always have a parameter where they switch from the initial state model to hydrodynamics. And if you change this parameter, you change the slope. So for instance, here there's a free streaming model. They overpredicted in this case where you switch at 1 femtometer, what we wanted to show. But if you start earlier, then you fit it spot on. For this zero flow model, if you change the parameter, you fit it spot on. But we don't have this parameter anymore where you start your hydrodynamics, because in ADS CFT you have very naturally transition to hydrodynamics. So where we switch from gravity to hydrodynamics, it doesn't matter at all because gravity predicts hydrodynamics. So we don't have this freedom. But even then, we fit the data spot on, which makes the simulation really nice. So in this case, we just collided delta shocks. So this is for LHC data, and we just collided delta shocks. So we don't collide the longitudinal dynamics at all, right? We just assume we start at some later time after the collision and assume it's boost invariant. So if you have boost invariance that at tau equals zero, your coordinates break down. So we don't have an actual collision here. We compare with the shockwave collision, where we do this delta shockwave collision for this central case, have a near boundary time expansion analytically before delta shocks, and that we put in at some finite time where we can start a numerical code.
So this higher code is in the 3 plus 1 or 2 plus 1?
So because the boosted invariant is, it's actually a 2 plus 1 code because it can do any non-central collision, so it's a fully, it can do any profile on the transverse plane, but in this case we have rotational symmetry, but we used it anyway. So in principle it's only 1 plus 1, right? Because you have the rho parameter and the time parameter. But in effect, we used the 2 plus 1 code because it was available.
What are the multiple deadlines
perspective? Yeah, so different parameters, like starting a little bit different, the numerical simulation, still fitting it. Yeah, and as I couldn't really explain, we have this extra parameter which fixes the horizon position. And we also tried to twiddle with that. And we saw that everything was pretty robust if our numerics were stable, and that are the different red lines. Yeah, I mean, it's not the most state of the art in the sense from that we would collide fully in 3 plus 1 dimensional ADS to real nuclei, but we have assumed this boost invariant and then matched it on. And of course, there's still work in progress. Yeah, what we really want to do is, well, this is my prospects, what I made is, what I want to do is to combine this longitudinal dynamics and this transverse dynamics. And then here you have two nuclei, like a little bit displaced, so you have an off-central collision. And what I then did is just assume that at every point, the transverse gradients are not so big. So the longitudinal dynamics is independent of the transverse dynamics. And if they're independent, I can combine my two approaches. And it's not unreasonable. Really. So here the longitudinal direction is like 0.4 femtometer. This is about 20 femtometers. So that these dynamics is approximately independent is not unreasonable. So I assume this, and then what you get is about this. So this is the energy density as a function of time, as a function of free space and parameters, just done by combining these shock waves. And yeah, you need to boost, you use some coordinate transformation to go to the right frame and to the right width and all that. But that's not so tricky. Yeah, and then the question is, of course, like what happens later on? So I got the 0.2 femtometers matching the, for instance, all these units, by the way, are matched by NC equals 3, and then matching the total energy of this nucleus to be the same as the total energy of the nucleus at LHC. So that fixes your units. And then the very last slide is, well, to just summarize a little bit that, so I had this disclaimer that we're doing not exactly the right thing, and especially this infinite coupling is really a problem, and probably suggests that we find a little bit too much stopping, like for instance, it is just the Yaffe shocks, that they don't really go fast enough. But then we also found that, at least at strong coupling, you don't necessarily have full stopping, although we did find some stopping. We didn't find boost invariance, but we found like a Gaussian, so there's still stopping. They don't have a rapidity independent spectrum. So, but yeah, so this might be, this really does get a little bit closer to real heavy ion collisions, this transparent regime. And then, yeah, some lessons that we could, now we have this model where you have this pre-equilibrium flow in hydrodynamics, where you can produce it dynamically using its ADCFT and then switch dynamically to hydrodynamics, which is really not present at all in the present literature. They just switch at some time where this time is conveniently chosen to represent the data. And yeah, and one of the lessons is that if you look at the units that I didn't say too much about, we find, from these shock waves, then we find much higher temperatures than what people typically consider. And this might be a bad thing, it might be that we are just having the wrong temperatures, but it might also point that at least it's possible, and in our strongly coupled models, we do find these higher temperatures, and hence oak much faster thermalization, like 1 over the temperatures then much smaller, so we find like thermalization already at 0.05 femtometers, which is very, very fast. And yeah, this is also a curiosity, which is also not present in current models, that the energy density grows initially, and then it decreases again. Normally, they just start with some energy density, and then it just decreases. But in our model, it initially grows. Well, I don't know if it's realistic. At least in this model, you can. This is a possibility. And then the recent thing which we're excited about is that you can just make, by doing these very simple shock waves, at least for the longitudinal direction, that there, you can predict the symmetry in the center of mass frame if you take into account how many nucleons you interacted with. And that this whole microstructure shouldn't really matter. You should just take the total energy together, and that should give you your proton net hydrodynamics. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Plot you show that with your combined code and fold. Given the disclaimers you have, isn't it surprising that you get it so well?
To some extent, yes. So we were surprised. That's definitely true. We're quite happy about it. On the other hand, you also have to notice that, for instance, here, what we plot, what we find for all the simulation, we plot the velocity at 1 femtometer over C. And we find that this velocity profile is kind of approximately universal. And in these hydrodynamic codes, if you start with the right energy density and the right velocity profile, then automatically you find the right spectra. So the energy density is just given by basically you take an atom and you look up what is the energy density. So the only thing which is kind of non-trivial is this velocity profile. And this is, well, to some extent you cannot, so it's good that we kind of get it, but it's not very surprising because it also follows just, it's kind of a universal thing.
Any other questions? If not, as I said, Vidka is here for several more months. So let's thank Vidka again.